Paper 12, section 8, old single column, page 139. All right, so shifting gears a little bit from where we were last week with the part and the whole. A lot of really solid contrasting between the father and the mother. They're gonna wrap up this paper, the final two sections. They're gonna do the chart here. You can see from how we start, matter, mind, spirit, and then the subsequent section is gonna be about personality. So you remember how that came up, a little ways back too. There, that they were really trying to get you to remember, like I mentioned, that very first bit of specific detailed in Revelation. It's up there at the beginning of the foreword. To always keep in mind the threefold actuality with unity. So let's see where they go with it this time.
8. Matter, mind, and spirit. God is spirit, but paradise is not. The material universe is always the arena wherein take place all spiritual activities. Spirit beings and spirit ascenders live and work on physical spheres of material reality. The be-soul of cosmic force, the domain of cosmic gravity, is the function of the Isle of Paradise. All original force energy proceeds from paradise, and the matter for the making of untold universes now circulates throughout the master universe in the form of a supergravity presence which constitutes the force charge of pervaded space. Whatever the transformations of force in the outlying universes, having gone out from paradise, it journeys on subject to the never-ending, ever-present, unfailing pull of the eternal isle, obediently and inherently swinging on forever around the eternal space paths of the universes. Physical energy is the one reality which is true and steadfast in its obedience to universal law. Only in the realms of creature volition has there been deviation from the divine paths and the original plans. Power and energy are the universal evidences of the stability, constancy, and eternity of the central Isle of Paradise.
Okay, so that's kind of fun, just what they're doing there. It's pretty straightforward. But so it starts out with a statement that is obviously geared toward your spiritual consciousness. God is spirit, paradise is not. So your spiritual consciousness is immediately thinking, yeah, that matter stuff, who cares? Unimportant. And then they turn it right back around on you. And remind you that, but at least it's obedient. Are you? literally using the word obedience.
As in obey the
one? Why do you languish in futile yearning? Because you obey not the truth. Yes. So you can kind of get a sense of what they're up to already. They're going to take on this long-standing problem with those who get a little bit of spiritual consciousness. That's the problem. They have a little bit of spiritual consciousness. And it immediately creates a very distorted view of things. It has a little spark of inspiration and lots of cluelessness that it's woven through. And so, to really challenge that initial tendency of your spiritual consciousness to turn everything into a dichotomy, to either have it the kind of dichotomy that basically ignores the other, or the kind of dichotomy that definitively looks down on the other, or you know, whatever. I mean, that whole bit about individuality, matter, etc., is on equal footing in the cosmos with spirit. Doesn't mean there can't be opposite perspectives, but you know, they're subjective perspectives. They're not, you have to challenge yourself to not absolutize that subjective perspective into some object or even absolute objective reality. And you notice one of the other things they threw in there right at the beginning, like I pointed out, one of the most radical statements in the whole book, right there in the preface of the Isle of Paradise paper, the previous paper, you know, that all beings are domiciled on material abodes. Repeating it there, you know, to really get all of that fuzziness out of your spiritual thinking. Everything is literal, definitive. There's no fuzzy spiritual planes or anything like that. Everything is literal. And every, you know, spirit being and spirit ascender lives and works on physical spheres of material reality. Yeah, and not just substance, material reality. The word that's down here with personality, the purposed word. Because, of course, to actually get down here to personality, you have to put all three together, not just spirit. So that very fact, you know, that personalities have to stand on material substance, is a simple reminder that genuine spiritual nature is the harmonization of the threefold actuality. You can see that by the fact that they perforce must stand on a material sphere. Yeah. It has to be that literal that the personality has taken its arms and wrapped around all three. You know, you have to have it within you. If you don't have it within you, you couldn't stand on it. And you need to stand on it, so you have to have it within you. Okay? So, you'll see, they're just going to build on that. That's just the gentle little start to that challenge of your immature spiritual consciousness.
The bestowal of spirit and the spiritualization of personalities, the domain of spiritual gravity, is the realm of the eternal sun. And this spirit gravity of the sun, ever drawing all spiritual realities to himself, is just as real and absolute as is the all-powerful material grasp of the Isle of Paradise. But material-minded man is naturally more familiar with the material manifestations of a physical nature than with the equally real and mighty operations of spiritual nature, which are discerned only by the spiritual insight of the soul. As the mind of any personality in the universe becomes more spiritual, godlike, it becomes less responsive to material gravity. Reality, measured by physical gravity response, is the antithesis of reality as determined by quality of spirit content. Physical gravity action is a quantitative determiner of non-spirit energy. Spiritual gravity action is the qualitative measure of the living energy of divinity.
All right, a couple things in there. You know, they start bringing in gravity, of course. You know, and before they did that, they reminded us again. Remember, we have two substances. So if you start out talking about how literal and essential to the whole picture of material substance is, at the same time, challenge yourself to think of spirit as a substance and just as literal as material substance. There's a gravity for each. So we've gone through that several times. So they're just strengthening that again. And they say, okay, so now Now think about that picture that we've just reminded you that we've spent a lot of time talking about already. What does your spiritual consciousness have a tendency to do to that objective picture? It tends to distort it through limited subjective perspective. Basically, why? Well, because spirit gravity grabs spirit substance, not material substance, and material gravity grabs material substance, not spirit substance. I mean, there is a definitive separation between the two, completely parallel, but definitively separated. Okay. So what is that going to have a tendency to do? Even though you don't initially recognize that spirit is a literal substance and all these sorts of things, your spiritual consciousness can have a very definitive feel to it because substance is literal and spirit gravity is literal and et cetera. And this can really exacerbate your tendency to bias your viewpoint of things, you know, to really end up thinking of spiritual things as more definitive or perhaps even really the only definitive literal thing. Okay? So they're kind of giving you the logical backing for that. I mean, it's because it is literal. And, you know, even if humans have never really had that notion of spirit substance being a literal thing, it is. And we super consciously are connected to that fact. And so in comes thesis antithesis. Okay? This is one of the three times in the book that they use the word antithesis. Okay? And that pair of words has caused a lot of problem over the last 150 years. And we don't really go out too far off on that tangent, but just notice that this paragraph is definitely not saying, you know, that whole theory about thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. Okay, no, we're not validating that. We're pointing out to you one of the ways in which you can get that false subjective thought in your head that there's some absoluteness, you know, or objectivity to thesis, antithesis. Think about what they just said before this. They're trying to get you to recognize the obvious. You can't have a relationship between a something and an absence of something, a thesis and an antithesis. Okay? Right. I mean, a relationship is between two somethings. The whole theory is illogical, no matter what form it takes. Yes, you can have this. There is that subjective differential because of the relativity of gravity. Like I was saying, I mean, spirit gravity only grabs a hold of spirit substance, not both, and vice versa. Okay, there's a relativity of the gravity and their appropriate substances. So that gives rise to one of the, you know, it's the generators of that false notion, that false philosophical notion.
If you're like a pure spirit, domiciled, do they have to have a form of gravitational provision for keeping the literalness intact?
Well, you know, this is part of the mystery, for instance, of the sun's worlds. Okay, you know, the eternal sun's worlds, the second paradise circuit, I mean, are definitive material worlds, and the beings are, you know, and even the word being is, you know, they're, you know, the other than personal individualities that are there, you know, even them, you know, as transcendent as they are, basically, even the revelator's understanding, you know. There they stand on things, on material worlds. Now, right at the very end, they slipped in the beginnings of some more serious challenge too. Okay, but first of all, notice how they just described spirit substance. So spiritual gravity action is the qualitative measure, and then instead of to describe spirit substance, they said living energy. Okay, one of the ways from basically as soon as I started talking about this with any specificity, I'm trying to help people to understand the contrast between the two substances, material substance and spirit substance. One of the easy ways that you can begin to think about the difference between the two is that if you're going to build a being out of material substance, like us, you have to add life animation to that matter before you can add mind to it and spirit and et cetera. You have to add life animation. It's not self-animating substance. But spirit substance is self-animating. You don't have to, if you're going to build a body out of that, you don't have to add life animation to it. It's self-animating. And that's what living energy, that's what they mean by that. It's self-animating substance. Okay, so there's that one little bit of kind of physics there. But now closer to home. Qualitative measure of the living energy of divinity. What are you going to do with that preposition? Is there a parenthetical that explains to you the proper interpretation of the preposition of? Am I supposed to assume that the preposition of means that is? You know, the spirit substance that is divinity? It's innately divine? Or am I supposed to interpret that it's derived from divinity? One thing you can note is they didn't say qualitative measure of the divine living energy. They didn't say that. Okay.
It takes the first one off the table.
But like I've pointed out, I mean, it's like Jesus' parables, the way the book is written. If you are not sophistry-proof, if you really choose to go off on the Lucifer tangent, they're going to construct it so that you can easily do that. It's up to you to have the insight to know that that doesn't mean divine living energy. It doesn't mean living energy that is divine. It doesn't mean that spirit substance is innately divine. It doesn't mean what Lucifer said, that spirit substance is innately divine, and then hence mind that's attached to it is also innately divine. My thoughts are innately divine, etc. Okay, spirit is just a substance. It's not innately divine. And to think it is the beginning of the path that Lucifer went on. It all hinges on one two-letter preposition. The beginning of a new journey of truth, or the beginning of the descent to oblivion. And it's your choice. Just like Jesus' parables. You can misinterpret them and go off. And he's not going to sit there and spoon feed it to you. You need to have the inner clarity. You need to have taken delight in cultivating. You don't get to paradise automatically. You have to choose with your own clarity.
Is there a substance that's innately divine?
Deity. Yeah, you mean you can think of that as sort of the highest substance in a sense. It's sort of a super substance. It's the substance beyond matter and spirit, transcendent of really the substances. You know, it's more of a, you know, when you have the expression sum and substance, you know, sum, that means above, you know, above and below standing, standing above and below. I mean, deity is sort of, you know, from our perspective, is that which stands above. It's a sum stance rather than a sub stance, you know, that which stands under. Okay, but for God, that personality stands on deity. It's personalized deity. That's the substance, you know, really that personality is identified with. It's the body, you know, of the core nature of the being is that deity. The personality circuit, that circuit flows through a conductor. You know, a conductor is some kind of a substance. It doesn't flow through spirit substance. It doesn't flow through material substance. It doesn't even flow through mindal energy. It flows through deity. That circuit flows through deity, the personality circuit. So in that sense, it's very much being treated substance-like. Okay. All right, so, you know, so there's, you know, now you know, you can probably guess the fact that I spent so much time on that. You know, that's really, of course, where this is headed. It all, that's the lever, fulcrum point in this section. I mean, you know, the word of is literally the fulcrum about which you're going to rock your teeter-totter. Which way are you going to go with the preposition of? Okay. So let's keep going here.
What paradise is to the physical creation, and what the eternal sun is to the spiritual universe, the conjoined actor is to the realms of mind, the intelligent universe of material, morontial, and spiritual beings and personalities. The conjoined actor reacts to both material and spiritual realities, and therefore inherently becomes the universal minister to all intelligent beings, beings who may represent a union of both the material and spiritual phases of creation. The endowment of intelligence, the ministry to the material and the spiritual in the phenomenon of mind, is the exclusive domain of the conjoined actor, who thus becomes the partner of the spiritual mind, the essence of the Marantia mind, and the substance of the material mind of the evolutionary creatures of time. Mind is the technique whereby spirit realities become experiential to creature personalities. And in the last analysis, the unifying possibilities of even human mind, the ability to coordinate things, ideas, and values, is supermaterial.
Okay, so they're rounding out the threefold actuality. We started out referring to the absolute of matter, the Isle of Paradise, followed that with the absolute spirit, the eternal sun, and here, of course, is the absolute mind, and you notice they very purposely used conjoint actor, not infinite spirit, because that's the, you know, technically, it's the third source and center is the conjoint actor that's the absolute mind. Not the third source and center is the infinite spirit. So they're very precise about that. Look at the fun use of language there. This domain of the conjoint actor who thus becomes the partner of the spiritual mind. Okay, so remember that you go way up when you, like, if you talk about the eternal sun himself, he's, you know, he's pure spirit. So his mind, you can't think of like we understand mind usually as an energy phenomenon that's bridging between spirit substance and material substance. There's no material substance, okay? And those very high facts, you know, are really in a mode where you could think of it as, the spirit is so pure that it's self-minded, or you could think of it in the sense it's really as if it's just pure deity, and deity is self-minded, is innately minded. Okay, that's sort of the top of the spectrum, and they're kind of alluding to that. If you think of the eternal Son, the absolute spirit, the partner of the absolute spirit is the absolute mind. So it's more, next to each other. And you come down, and when you think about Marantia mind, okay, now Marantia substance, we've talked about this before. I mean, the easiest way to really think about what that artificial substance is it's like taking mind energy and making a substance out of it. Making a substance that's intermediate between spirit substance and material substance. It's Marantia substance in between, that literally is a body bridging substance for us, etc., from material body to a spirit body. The substance itself is like mind. Seeing how they word that, the essence of Marantia mind, it's all just in what it is, so you're sort of right there just with it, as opposed to, and in it, as opposed to next to it, like the partner word. And then, and the substance of the material mind, the conjoint actor, the absolute mind, is the absolute anchor point upon which and around which all mind, like we understand mind, is centered, is anchored. It's what stands under that whole phenomenon, the substance, that absolute anchor point of mind as we know it. Conjoint actor is the absolute of that kind of mind. Okay, so they're really having some fun with getting you to think precisely using the language like that. Yep.
I thought in the past you've talked about Marantia as being like material and spirit woven together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And mindal energy. On the one end, it blends imperceptibly into spirit substance, and on the other end, it blends imperceptibly into material substance. So, follow the two facts inward. It's, it's like material energy and spirit energy, blended together, just mind energy. So instead of being a homogeneous blend, essentially like mind energy, Marantia is a heterogeneous weave. But it's the two energies, again, brought intimately together and held together artificially.
But you just talked about it being spiritual mindal substance.
It's like mind. It's like the two endpoints brought together. It's just like mind made substance. See? Okay. And then, that little reminder that mind is where the consciousness is. Mind is the technique whereby spirit realities become experiential to creature personalities. This is always the case, no matter how high you are. Spirit is an endpoint substance. Even very high mind consciousness is in the mind, not in the spirit substance or in the, the matter. Okay, so everything you experience about spirit is indirect in that sense. It's coming from the spirit into the mind and then being recognized. Instead of things, meanings, and values, things, ideas, and values, just as a twist on it. You notice on the chart here, one of the sequences I put in on here I should show it here. Ideas, associations of ideas and ideals. Okay. One of the things you can do with this chart is think about how you start with things, meanings, and values. And all of that is ideas in the mind, the idea of things, the idea of meanings, the idea of values. Like they were just saying, I mean, values that's only recognized when it's brought into the mind. You don't engage the quality of the spirit directly. It comes into the mind. So you have the idea of values. So you have sort of this new beginning of a thing, this super thing that wraps around things, meanings, and values, this notion of an idea. So you start the pattern over again. So then you have ideas as a new thing, and then, you know, you take it up through associativity and unity again, up to ideals. There's, you know, it's a hierarchical phenomenon like that, the way the chart works. Another one that we've pointed out is, you have, I guess we should show it right here, fact, truth, and goodness. And you also, down here, have the spirit of truth. And so you can go, that's kind of a new anchor point. Let's take it up a notch to a higher threefold pattern that builds upon that and have the spirit of fact, the spirit of truth, and the spirit of goodness. Where the spirit of fact is the Holy Spirit, where you had it broken up into three things across them, you know, now it's coming together into one thing. It's a new fact, the spirit of fact. All together is one, the Holy Spirit. And then the spirit of truth would fit here. And then there would be a spirit of goodness. There would be what's the spirit of goodness? What's the third spirit fact that engages you? The thought adjuster. Yeah. Another name for the thought adjuster is the spirit of goodness. And you can just deduce that. You know, it's a point of goodness that's put into your mind, a reference point. What does good look like? Look to the adjuster. That's what good looks like. Make your mind good like that. What does truth look like? Look to the spirit of truth. That's what truth looks like. Make your mind look like that. What does objective fact look like? Look to the Holy Spirit. That's your reality response. That's what fact looks like. You know, material fact, mindful fact, spiritual fact, etc. It's little things like that should start to get you thinking about, you know, what you might call in a modern phraseology, the fractal kind of sense of the threefold actuality pattern. It's just everywhere, superimposed and within, and, you know, I mean, it's just a universalized pattern that you can see all over. All right. Let's a little further here.
Though it is hardly possible for the mortal mind to comprehend the seven levels of relative cosmic reality, the human intellect should be able to grasp much of the meaning of three functioning levels of finite reality.
Okay, before you read those, this is they do this a couple times before they finally lay them out. Let me just point you. If you go up to two papers ahead to the Central Universe paper, on page 156 in the single column, you know, it's section 4, paper 14, section 4, in the midst of talking about the Central Universe, they throw out a list of seven. Yeah, that's what they're alluding to here. How did they say it here? Comprehend the seven levels of relative cosmic reality, or they'll call it the seven levels of universe reality sometimes. Not to be confused with what goes on way up there in paper 106. Okay? What they're referring to is this list of seven here, which in this context they describe as material, morontial, spiritual. In other words, basically the threefold finite. Absonite, ultimate, co-absolute, absolute. That sevenfold hierarchy. And so what they're saying is, though it is hardly possible for the mortal mind to comprehend, you know, anything like absonite, ultimate, co-absolute, absolute in any direct way, the finite part, the threefold actuality part, matter, mind, spirit, or mind made substance, matter, marantia, spirit, like they're saying, you should be able to grasp much of the meaning of that threefold actuality. And notice what they give now. So back to the paper we're reading. They just give literally matter, mind, spirit. Okay. In other words, the threefold finite actuality. You have those first two triodities that establish that threefold finite energy substance pattern of matter, mind, spirit. The two triodities that establish the substantiveness of the finite. The other 18 triodities are about the absentite. Okay. But those first two triodities are about the potential for matter, mind, and spirit and the actuality of matter, mind, and spirit. So that's what they're saying. They're saying you ought to be able to get a much better understanding of what the finite is about, you know, as a threefold actuality. Okay. Oh, what do they say?
One, matter. Organized energy which is subject to linear gravity except as it is modified by motion and conditioned by mind. Two, mind. Organized consciousness which is not wholly subject to material gravity and which becomes truly liberated when modified by spirit. Three, spirit. The highest personal reality. True spirit is not subject to physical gravity, but eventually becomes the motivating influence of all evolving energy systems of personality dignity.
Okay, so I wanted him to read all three before we dissected them. So you get the overall spirit of what they're doing there. You have the idea that you are a finite being. You have a material component, a mindful component, a spiritual component, and it's all encompassed by the fourth fact here on the chart, personality. Okay. And in that threefold actuality with personality identified to it, there's a hierarchical nature to that. Definitely initially, you need to understand it as personality coming down, engaging spirit, spirit going down, engaging mind, mind going down and engaging matter. Like you can see they pointed to, personality is spirit pattern. That's the way you basically understand what it is. So it grabs a hold of the spirit substance. And spirit energy dominates mindful energy, mind energy. And mind energy dominates matter. To a point, like they're saying. You know, so now let's look at some of the details. So, you know, matter, how it's conditioned by mind. You can't do any old thing, but I can definitely tell my arm to move around because that's what my mind is telling the matter to do. Okay? The mind is dominating the matter here. Or I can move the cup. That's mind dominating that matter. And then also the motion. Maybe just take a simple little thing that we'll talk some more about as we go forward. They just mentioned the force charge of space. And we know one of the first things that the force organizers do with the force charge is they'll make a big whirl in it to get a galaxy started. You know, so there's a motion there. They've added a motion to it. You start throwing matter into that. Well, the matter will do what it does via linear gravity, like they mentioned. You know, things will, you know, there'll be a center of mass and things will be in, you know, Newtonian linear gravity orbit about that center of mass. But they're also, that matter is caught up in that whirl. When you look at a galaxy, you know, if you look at a spiral galaxy edge on out in the outer space levels, and you look at the velocities of the stars going around the center, you're looking at it edge on, you'll see some of them are going to be moving away, and on the other side, they're going to be coming at you. So you can look at the Doppler shift of the light and tell how fast the stars are going around the center, And if it was all just linear gravity, there would be a certain curve as a function of radius that those velocities would behave. The velocities would drop off, you know, just like Pluto going around the sun goes around really slowly compared to Mercury. You know, the solar system doesn't rotate like a record platter. There's differential revolution about the center. You'd expect that with the stars in the galaxy, but you don't see that. You see the outer things going much faster than you would expect if they were just in, you know, Keplerian, Newtonian, linear gravity orbit about the center mass of the galaxy. It's because they're caught up in the whirl. So, you know, that's a simple example of modified by motion. Not motion of matter, motion. Motion that's antecedent, way antecedent to matter.
How does science, current day science, explain that?
They don't, you know, really. I mean, they recognize it, that's where one of the dark matter notions enters into the picture. Not dark energy, but dark matter, to try to rationalize it. But that's just, there's a bunch of things about that they just ignore. The parts that they do acknowledge, they try to rationalize with some fabricated notion, like some fanciful dark matter particle or something. Okay. All right, so there's that. And then you can see it just, you know, you go up a notch and, okay, we have, our adjutant mind is quite material. In terms of that energy spectrum, it's much more matter-like than spirit-like in terms of that the type of energy that our adjutant mind is made of. So it's definitely impacted by material gravity. Material gravity is constantly trying to drag us down into a depression, trying to drag our consciousness down. We have to choose to have a spirit nature to that mindal energy that spirit gravity can grab a hold of and lift us up out of depression, for instance. So, it's not wholly subject to material gravity, but of course the lower the mind, the more it is subject to material gravity, the less you've consecrated yourself to your consciousness being more towards the spirit end of the spectrum, the more it's going to be subject to that. And it becomes truly liberated when it's modified by spirit, because spirit dominates mind. So, that whole fact that spirit fundamentally dominates mind, if you can identify your mind with spirit, sort of bond the two together, there's a spirit gravity that will help that will lift the spirit up and hence lift your mind up.
Where do you put emotional energy into this?
Basic feelings, you know, level of feelings, emotional energy, as you're thinking of it, is the second level of meaning. That's basically adjutants 4, 5, and 6. That emotional energy, or energy that could emote, you know, feeling type mindal energy, is not as dominated by material gravity as the first three adjutants, which are down a notch in the level of the flesh. But it's only one notch up. So, you know, it's not that much removed in terms of being affected by material gravity. I mean, and that's why if it was really removed, there wouldn't be depression. I mean, your feelings wouldn't go down in the dumps. That's the whole point. I mean, you know, material gravity is dragging your feelings down. It's just a literal thing. Material gravity is pulling your feelings down, and you become depressed. You're in the dumps. You're down in the dregs of your mind. Okay, so the only way to truly overcome that is to get identified with the upper domain of the hourglass. You know, get yourself really identified with the Holy Spirit. Now you got some literal spirit substance that is fully engaged by spirit gravity. And if you have a hold of that, it's going to hold you up. You're not going to go into depression anymore. But if you're basically dominated by agitated mind, you're prone to depression.
A good thing that has come up recently that validates that very thing about depression being a physical thing is it's been discovered that literally people can be emotionally helped out of depression by taking pain pills.
Right. And the very fact is you can use chemistry, you know, whether it comes from a pharmaceutical tract or is growing out in the backyard, it doesn't matter. You know, you're using chemistry. So how high a mind are we dealing with here if chemistry affects it?
Right.
Say, not very high mind. Yeah. What you need is spirit gravity. Yeah, like I've tried to point out, when Jesus came upon someone who was depressed, he didn't hand him a pill. Yeah, he didn't say, what you need to do is twist on the matter. No, what you need to do is grab a hold of spirit and it will lift you up. Yeah. You know, you are not a helpless victim of material causation. Okay, like my material gravity. You have a choice. You have free will. You can choose to grab a hold of spirit, you know, and you can supply the favorable conditions, and then she will grow you. She will lift you up, and if all you have is, you know, it's just the sixth adjutant, you know, that you're calling spiritual. It's like, well, okay, yeah, it's in the unity-like block here. It's spirit-like, definitely, but it's still mindal energy, and it's still subject to a lot of material gravity. Just trying to antidote depression with the sixth adjutant is not going to give you peace that passes all understanding. It'll give you occasional sporadic peace until something more aggressive, you know, externally, you know, challenges you, and then, you know, down you go again. You need something a lot stronger than the sixth adjutant. You need the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
Yeah, because if you get up to the sixth adjutant, your depressive cycles will be even more dramatic.
Exactly. Right. It just means that the swings can get more violent. Right. Okay. So you have that, and then you've got this threefold matter, mind, spirit. You know, in the highest domains of this whole personal reality that we're talking about, you know, is up there in the spiritual domain. True spirit is not subject to physical gravity, but eventually becomes the motivating influence of all evolving energy systems of personality dignity. You know, remember way back, I suppose it was in the religion papers when we were, you know, talking about that whole matter, mind, spirit, personality, you know, vertical structure, and how the whole point is to get the phenomenon top down, oriented top down, so that the spirit can direct the mind. Since spirit dominates mind, if you rightly purpose spirit, you know, it will truthfully direct the mind, you know, and the mind dominates the matter. I mean, you'll get the whole threefold system in play: health in the body, sanity in the mind, and happiness in the spirit. Okay, but that only is achieved top down. Happiness leads to sanity, leads to health. You can't somehow twist, you know, play with chemicals of any sort, growing in your backyard or not, and expect it to eventuate into happiness. Okay, doesn't work that way. Tail doesn't wag the dog. Okay.
You guys know a lot about health.
Yeah.
But you don't know much about happiness.
Right. Right. Because it's sad to record, you know very little about the top-down perspective. Okay. So, like Jesus said, I mean, you basically know about the first two levels of meaning. You know about rattling between the two. I'm feeling things. I'm happier, so I say, you know. No, I'm not. No, I mean, no. I mean, you're not actually. See, you're misusing the word happy. Right. Happiness is not joy. Okay. You may feel joy a little bit, then until something stresses you, and now you don't feel joy anymore. Happiness is a choice. In spite of difficulties, you choose to be happy. You choose to dwell up where you can feel joy. Again, it's top-down. Personality dominates spirit. You're choosing to be right in spirit, to be able to feel joy, even in the midst of very difficult circumstances. Okay. Okay, so that kind of in that spirit, they go forward here.
The goal of existence of all personalities is spirit. Material manifestations are relative, and the cosmic mind intervenes between these universal opposites. The bestowal of mind and the ministration of spirit are the work of the associate persons of deity, the infinite spirit and the eternal son. Total deity reality is not mind, but spirit mind. Mind-spirit unified by personality. Nevertheless, the absolutes of both the spirit and the thing converge in the person of the universal Father.
Okay, I mean, I think you basically get most of that. But notice that one kind of little technical one thrown in there with the sentence with the M dash in it. So total deity reality is not mind, but spirit mind. And then parenthetically, mind-spirit unified by personality. What are they trying to play with the language there to get you to think about? Okay, so it's not mind. Reminding you, spirit's in play too. And so your initial thought is that you have sort of a foundational mind fact, and spirit is added to that, added on top of that. So spirit-mind. But then they say, well, instead of looking at it like that, instead of saying, okay, here I am, mind, and then above me is spirit, it's added to my mind. Mind is the foundation word. Spirit is added on top of it. Instead of looking at it from the bottom up, take the top-down point of view, okay? Where it's starting with, the unifying influence of your personality, and the first thing that it engages, what it sees as the foundation that it's getting a hold of, is spirit. And then mind is added to that. You start with happiness and health, and sanity is added to that, for instance. Or you start with perfecting spirit, and that leads to progressing mind. See, that's why they're flipping it like that. To get you to think about it from the top-down point of view, where you hit spirit before you hit mind, rather than mind and then spirit. Yeah. So just exactly what I was saying before.
Yep. And that's what every human, bona fide human, has the potential to do that with the initiator.
Right. Yeah. And then, notice they threw in the universal father at the end. Because where did the personality come from? That's going to initiate this top down phenomenon
right. From
the initiator, from the father.
But then don't just stay there with that strong initiation point and bliss out.
Right. Take it down.
Yeah, yeah.
Take a consecration to the spiritual father down to a consecration of mind to the cosmic mother.
Yeah.
Take it down.
Yeah.
I don't really feel like I'm connecting up total deity reality with the spirit of that sentence.
Okay, now...
that's a small t
total? Yeah, it's a small t, yeah. So just... I mean, the challenge there... is to they're really taking you to the full picture of not just thinking about matter, mind, and spirit and some magical other that gives you personality or something. This is all the consequence of deity. This is all in a total deity reality. So, it's not immediately... They're reminding you that deity is behind the reality that we're talking about. So it's just sort of a subtle passing challenge to take it up even a bigger notch if you can, you know, to really bring in a full top-down point of view where it all begins with deity, you know, and then is made real, made substance, made God, made, you know, et cetera. That's for the initiated, who's, you know, those of us who have spent some time, you know, working on total deity, you know, that, you know, that you just that, see, the first two words throws you into a full top-down point of view. You don't have to, you know, dissect the spirit, mind, spirit thing, you know. See, that's obviously the whole point. They're trying to really invoke the full top-down point of view. You know, it's deity and reality. It's deity reality. The Father can initiate a relationship to both matter and spirit and the association of mind between them, because you follow those three things back and they converge together as one fact in the Father behind the Eternal Son and the Conjoint Actor and the Isle of Paradise. So how appropriate is that? That's where personality comes from, that which is transcendent of the three absolutes of the actuality, so that it could possibly encompass the threefold actuality and produce that unification, you know, unified by personalities that they're referring to. All right.
On Paradise, the three energies, physical, mindal, and spiritual, are coordinate. In the evolutionary cosmos, energy matter is dominant except in personality, where spirit, through the mediation of mind, is striving for the mastery. Spirit is the fundamental reality of the personality experience of all creatures because God is spirit. Spirit is unchanging, and therefore, in all personality relations, it transcends both mind and matter, which are experiential variables of progressive attainment.
One little thing there. Spirit is unchanging. Why are they really putting that in? This is another little reminder about a contrast between the two substances. When, you know, our experience with matter is definitively not unchanging, is definitively changing. You know, if nothing else, we age. Okay, everyone in this room, well, almost everyone in this room, is pretty aware of one way in which a material expression changes, you know, a metamorphosis. So there's a lot of ways that matter, you know, has a variability, a changeableness like that. That very fact life animation that you had to add to matter to make it living matter, that connection begins to degrade, which, you know, results in aging, which, you know, is literally manifest as is not just the same matter not working as well, but changing. Completely. You know, it morphs. Okay, spirit substance doesn't morph like that, and it's not just because, you know, it's self-animated. It's just, you know, even in Havona, I see him, you know, here I could even, it's right after that list of seven, and they say, decay and death are not a part of the cycle of life on the Havona worlds. In the central universe, the lower living things undergo the transmutation of materialization. Okay, so, you know, there's no decay and death there, but the material facts there still undergo the transmutation of materialization. There's a changingness, you know, changing to the materialization. It's not aging, but it changes. Spirit substance doesn't do that. But even very high material substance changes like that. Okay, so that's what they're, you know, they're getting at there with that little statement. You know, and so that whole bit about, you know, personality is changeless. So, and it's personality, spirit pattern. It's identifying first with that spirit substance, which is also changeless, fun, you know, innately. See how its likes coming together, like things coming together. Okay. All right. So that's what's between the lines there. And, you know, if we're going to be fully experiential beings, see, you need the mind and the matter. See, which are the experiential variables? Just reminding you, one another reason how you can understand why these facts come into association with spirit, it's how the variableness is implemented. Yeah, so that you can actually have experiential things instead of just existential things that just are.
I've long thought that the whole idea of creation was at its very foundation a technique to alleviate the boredom of changelessness.
it's certainly one way to think about
it. It's the creation of a vehicle whereby changelessness can experience change.
Yeah, that's definitely one of the truths of, you know, why there isn't just an I am. Because, wow, the mind-numbing changelessness of the I am. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's so changeless, it's from our perspective, it's nothing.
Where is spirit in a human being? Is it in the soul?
Well, initially...
I know there's the adjuster of spirit, but that's...
But not even set the adjuster and the soul aside. You know, when you initially think about that hierarchy, you don't even have this necessarily the spirit of truth in play. You just have your body with life animation added to it, and the mind, the whole spectrum going up, and then there's the Holy Spirit, which is, you know, really above you. You have a mindful self, not a spiritual self. I mean, so the spiritual domain is really above you. And even though you bring in the spirit of truth, it's just like the Holy Spirit. It's above you. What it's definitively doing is it's allowing the upper domains of your mindal energy to take on more unity-like character. So kind of technically what you mean by the spiritual domain of you is the upper reaches of your mindal energy that have been very much, what's the word, you know, modified by spirit, as they say right here, see? Okay. But the thought adjuster is actually in the mind, but of course, you haven't fused with it. So there's a separateness there, but at least it's at eye level. You know, it's not up. You don't have to reach way up above your mind to touch it. It is right there. But qualitatively, of course, it's quite remote, even though, if, you know, distance-wise, it's, you know, it's intimate.
But 6 circles away.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's still as many circles away. It's many cosmic levels away.
Well, is it really in our conscious mind, or rather in our superconscious?
Well, I mean, the way we normally do, you know, the hourglass thing, okay? I mean, really see what we're doing there. You know, we say that upper domain, that volume of that upper domain is established by the three cosmic intuitions, making three levels, making some volume, three floors. But what you mean is there's an influence imposed above that establishes a space with three floors, and mind energy is drawn up into that. So that now your mind energy has an upper domain to it that's being influenced by the Holy Spirit. And in that upper domain, the adjuster comes and takes residence. So if you take it out of the hourglass thing, you have, you know, if you just like think of a column instead of energy, you know, and your consciousness is at some level in this column of mindal energy, the adjuster is up above where your consciousness is in the superconscious domain of that mindal energy system. You know, and you're working on, you know, there here you can really visualize those cosmic levels of the psychic circles. You're trying to move up to where you can come into intimate contact with where the adjuster is, because it can only reach down to the, you know, to that supreme level. You know, remember, if you picture it very vertically, linearly, in the psychic circles in the sevenfold chart, the adjuster can only reach down to the fourth cosmic level here, that supreme level. So you have to get yourself up. There's just, the different analogies allow you to think about the different parts of it, and better understanding of some parts and some analogies and vice versa. But that's the basic idea. Your consciousness is always just in your mind. It's just that the lower parts of the mind are very material-like and the upper parts are very spirit-like. And so you can kind of speak of, a body-like part of the mind, just the core of the mind, and then a spirit-like part of the mind, and the material, the mindful, the spiritual. I mean, after all, what's the bottom level of meaning called? The level of the flesh. Sounds body-like to me. They're trying to give you a language that, allows for easy way to think about it. where were we here? Let's see. Oh, yeah, the unchanging. Okay, yeah, so I think we got that. Okay, so, yeah, keep going.
In cosmic evolution, matter becomes a philosophic shadow cast by mind in the presence of spirit luminosity of divine enlightenment. But this does not invalidate the reality of matter energy. Mind, matter, and spirit are equally real, but they are not of equal value to personality in the attainment of divinity. Consciousness of divinity is a progressive spiritual experience.
Okay, the last two paragraphs here. pretty much everyone knows immediately what they're alluding to here. This is Plato, of course. This is Platonism. This is that basic, like you're saying, philosophic notion that developed out of this initial immature spiritual consciousness. You get a little bit of spiritual consciousness because spirit is a literal substance, because there's spiritual gravity. It's all very literal and, physics-like. It's physical-like. You can definitely conclude that it's definitive, but you can go overboard with that and decide it's the only substance, the only reality. That all there really is spirit, and matter is just a shadow, that it's not substantive, actually. It's kind of an illusion, a projection at best. Okay? And that basic distortion, because that's what an immature spiritually conscious individual like Plato did. Doesn't matter how brilliant he was, he's obviously, an immature spiritual consciousness, because he was coming up with that distorted picture of making spirit the only thing that was really real. But they're about to say, well, let's think about it a little bit, exactly why did it seem so definitive to him? Because he was a smart guy. He was really analyzing things very carefully and precisely, thinking about them intensely. And it seemed rock solid, this picture he was getting. And that's why still today it rules a lot of human thought. He presented it very definitively, made a really great case. So they're trying to give you some of the physics sort of motivation behind that. If you really have a mind, it's in the presence of spirit luminosity of divine enlightenment. Okay, notice, is spirit innately divine? No, there's spirit and it's substantive, like of luminosity. But then you've added divine enlightenment to it. Okay? You can get, it can be so intense, this luminosity, when it's made, quite right by divine enlightenment, by appropriate consecration of your person, of your personality, of your that purposing of spirit, that this the matter kind of just gets lost in the glare. Okay. But now, if Plato and others had just taken their logical reflection one more step, it's like, wait a minute. If I'm saying that this spirit luminosity casts a shadow, if there was no relationship between spirit and matter, spirit luminosity, you know, this vector phenomenon that's radiating from spirit substance, wouldn't know that matter was there. It would pass right through it. It wouldn't impinge upon it and cast a shadow. The very fact that you think that what you're seeing is a shadow means that matter and spirit are on equal footing.
And there's a third thing shining behind spirit. Because for a shadow to be cast, there has to be three things.
I mean, yeah, you can bring in the whole picture. But just, you know, that simple dichotomy, just see, you know, there's intellectual luminosity too, and, you know, but see, just to think about it logically, if there's no floor, the light above me is not going to cast a shadow. I mean, you know, why is there a shadow? Because it's being made by photons, which are like the floor. If you use spirit luminosity instead of material luminosity, photons, and there's a shadow cast, the spirit luminosity has to be like what it's striking. There's not going to be a shadow. Just the thought itself, see, is it's on the way it's expressed is its own undoing.
I was never particularly drawn in by that idea, probably because I didn't have that strong spiritual consciousness in action.
I mean, you had enough that you are here,
yeah. But
you know, you started out with a healthy amount of material pragmatism in your initial genetic, you know, favoring of the dichotomy. But there's an awful lot of people that, you know, material pragmatism is, you know, is just nothing. You know, and if they're really intelligent, they come up with a very elaborate rationalization scheme that proves that it's just an illusion. You know, that whole material stuff and the pragmatism that's tied with it and everything. You know, what's one of the things that we call Platonism? We call it idealism. You know, it's one of the flavors of philosophic idealism. It's fixating on this block where the word ideals is, the spirit block. Okay. So, you know, we basically just logically could see that it does not invalidate the reality of matter and energy. It actually, if that's a real definitive picture, it basically demonstrates the reality, you know, not the actuality, the reality, the commonality of matter and energy. And here's where, you know, you have this very direct statement in the book, right in the section where there's antithesis mentioned, and that whole tendency for someone, you know, to get into that mode where spirit is thesis and matter is antithesis. Okay, I mean, there is nothing further from the fifth epical revelation than that thought. I mean, to have that thought is to have really no relationship to the fifth epical revelation. You've got nothing but old wineskins that you're pouring this thing into.
As far as the one I can see.
If you don't have this, threefold actuality, the very first thing that they told you in the revelation, if you don't have that, you have nothing, really. You got a lot of wishful thinking and fuzzy thoughts. Okay? The fifth epical revelation is founded, paragraph 3, it's founded on the fact that matter, or mind, matter, and spirit are equally real. Notice it even used that spirit word. equal, okay, and real, okay? From the eyes of the, you know, if you want to start with a father understanding of this, put yourself in the place of the universal father. Does he see any difference between the substance of the isle and the substance of the body of the eternal son? No, I mean, the revelators tell you not even they can. It's just a difference in name only to them, okay? I mean, no, they're equally real, okay? That is the foundation of the fifth epical revelation, to have not the slightest shred of differential objectively between matter and spirit and the mind that links them. You can only link them if the endpoints are equally real. You can't have a relationship between two dissimilars. There have to be a similarity in order for them to be relatable. They have to be equally real.
They have to be something.
Right. Okay. But there is a difference. We all know there's some difference. Okay, if it's not a literal objective thing, it must be subjective. And what is that? Yeah, there's two types of purposing. There's energy pattern and spirit pattern, because there's two substances. Energy pattern or just pattern, spirit pattern, personality. We're a personal being. We're initially understanding things from a personal vantage point, which innately is a spirit vantage point. That's what you're seeing first, so they say, but they are not of equal value to personality in the attainment of divinity, because personality is not energy pattern, it's spirit pattern. But that's the only difference. It's not because spirit pattern is better than energy pattern. Okay, it's just different. Okay?
Strong statement, equally real.
Yeah.
The adjuster puts a slight preference on the altruistic principle as leading to, you know, happiness.
And initially, because we're in this mode, we relate to an adjuster as pure spirit. But the adjuster is equally, not also, equally pure energy.
Yeah.
Okay? Now think about, there's a very overt, externalized expression of us overcoming this initial bias. Okay, we start out in a domain, that paragraph that's right after the list of matter, mind, spirit. Remember where they had spirit hyphen mind, and then they had mind hyphen spirit. Okay, we start out in a domain that is spirit hyphen mind, from matter through mind to spirit. Okay, that gets us to the threshold of Havona, from individuality through associativity to an initial unity. And then when you go into the central universe, and it flips around. The foundation there is not matter, it's spirit. You start anew, and you go from unity through associativity to individuality. Now you fully have gone experientially through the threefold actuality, both directions, you know, what we would think is bottom up and top down, but we're progressing, we're going up the whole time, the universe flips, the central universe flips the other way, so we keep going up and in, but now we go from spirit through mind to matter, really, I mean, and, you know, really kind of go beyond thinking of it like that. You're going from unity through associativity to a transcendent individuality. The kind of individual, because he's got the fullness of both directions, he's a bidirectional fact now, he's supreme, you're supreme-like, you can stand on the aisle and become a finaliter. But you have to go through both. You have to start in a domain of spirit-mind and then go to a domain of mind-spirit.
You get to the shores of Avona and you see this hourglass getting...
Really? That's all we're doing?
You're starting anew. Behold, all things become new when you walk through the gates of Havona. Yeah. Okay, so let's get that light. He's going to give us a little bit more Platonism here.
The brighter the shining of the spiritualized personality, the father in the universe, the fragment of potential spirit personality in the individual creature, the greater the shadow cast by the intervening mind upon its material investment. In time, man's body is just as real as mind or spirit, but in death, both mind, identity, and spirit survive while the body does not. A cosmic reality can be non-existent in personality experience. And so your Greek figure of speech, the material as the shadow of the more real spirit substance, does have a philosophic significance.
Like I said, he's just kind of giving us a little bit of a sense of why Plato could come to that conclusion. Probably just one little thing is the parenthetical. Let's just make sure that we appreciate. When they said, but in death, both mind, and they said parenthetical, identity, and spirit survive. I mean, your jester survives. Your adjutant mind, your mind or self dies. That's what dies, okay? It doesn't survive. I mean, what technically survives is a potential identity, one way to talk about it. What survives is your selfhood, another way to talk about it, because it's actually your selfhood that the personality is identifying with, more precisely than just the self, because selves come and go, but the selfhood is ongoing, and that's that ongoing fact is what matches up with the ongoingness, the changelessness of personality. That's what's the two that are really meeting, the selfhood that threads through all the selves, you know, every self on each of the seven mansion worlds, etc. And that's, you know, so that, you know, it's that selfhood. It's or like they say when they're resurrecting you, they resurrect your potential identity. They resurrect what the personality is going to identify with. They know what they need to build there, so that it's the same potential identity. There's no break in the selfhood. You know, and for instance, if you're died at a real young age and are resurrected in the probationary nursery, they literally use the word potential identity there, because, I mean, you don't have a soul, for instance, maybe. You know, you may have died so young you don't even have a soul. So it's not like that's what, you know, they just need to make sure is there that the personality can identify with again. You know, and they're going to change a whole bunch of things. You know, you're not going to be reproducing. You know, they know all the things about the body that they're going to build for you that they can change, and what they can't. What has to be very precisely the same still, so that the same personality, it's the same potential identity, it's the same fact that personality is going to identify with.
Which is another validation of material foundation.
Yeah, stuff. Right. Just think about how definitive that's what that's saying about this connection between personality and matter. It's not just soul, you know, or something, okay? But, you know, nothing but matter going on when you're resurrecting on the probationary nursery. So, and you know, they don't resurrect you as reproducing males and females. It's like, well, isn't that an essential part of my selfhood? No, personality is not male or female. It doesn't need male or female matter, okay? Personality is not male or female. Selves are male and female. But that mortal self died.
Say somewhere in the Urantia book that
Your maleness and that continues on. How does it continue on? I mean, when you're standing on the Isle of Paradise, the thing you're thinking of, and I can, you know, two of us are standing on the Isle of Paradise, and I can look at you, and I can tell that back when you were on the planet Earth, you were female to start with. How can I tell that? Well, I'm looking at you, you know, you are your experiences there. I see your experiential nature. I know that the only way that kind of an experiential construct gets built is if it started as a female. You can't build that starting as a male.
So is that part then of your identity?
It's part of your ongoing nature. I don't want to say this, but it's not the essential part, really, that personality is. There's an accumulating experiential self. There's a core thread of that experiential self that fundamentally the personality is identifying with. And that core thread is not male or female. What's wrapped around it has a male or female flavor if it started out male or female. But just think of all the stuff that gets added to that that's beyond your mortal life. I mean, the tiniest little bit has that male or female direct flavor. But it's enough that you can still see it even when you're a finality and you have this vast accumulation of nature that is trans male and female as a mortal. But that little bit. But again, it's all predicated on this thread that is not male or female, that's like personality, that's like the adjuster. You know, the adjusters make no consideration of whether you're a male or female when they pick you because it's irrelevant, you know, to their transcendent relationship to you, just like it's irrelevant to the transcendent relation of personality to you.
I still have some difficulty understanding, I guess, the difference between identity and personality.
Yeah, I mean, fundamentally, identity is, you take a self, if personality engages it, now that self is an identity. So it's basically a word that indicates an upstepped self. A self that has personality engaged to it. When you can and go beyond that, go beyond just the spirit sort of picture with personality. Technically, you have an identity if you take some actuality and you engage pattern to it of any kind. You purpose that actuality and make it a reality. Now it's an identity. The Isle of Paradise is an identity, not a personality identity. It's a pattern identity, an energy pattern identity. It's an identity. It's purposed. So it's a purposed actuality. But in the case of us, I mean, the way to think about it is you have a mindful self, you have an actuality, personality engages it. And now that's an identity. Personality has identified with that self. It has, and you know, reached down and seated on that self. Identified with that self.
A cosmic reality can be non-existent in personality experience.
Right. I mean, you know, the matter stuff. I mean, that's why Plato could get it. I mean, you can really kind of just go into a spirit mind instead of spirit mind matter space. So the matter is really not there, which means really the full threefold cosmic thing is not there. That's what they're getting at. I mean, it's because your inner life can so exist so independent of matter, or so it seems, that you can convince yourself that matter really isn't substantive. You can look around and you just don't see it inside. It's like, yeah, but you feel it out here, don't you? It's like, well, yeah, but I think I'm just, you know, imagining that. That's what it's getting out there.
Powerful.
All right. If a tree falls in the forest, you know, I mean, it's that thing. Right.
Hi. Personal realities. Spirit is the basic personal reality in the universes. And personality is basic to all progressing experience with spiritual reality. Every phase of personality experience on every successive level of universe progression swarms with clues to the discovery of alluring personal realities. Man's true destiny consists in the creation of new and spirit goals and then in responding to the cosmic allurements of such supernal goals of non-material value.
The word supernal is a top-down word. I think I mentioned that one time. Yeah. I always remember that. And they use that word there, invoking it top-down. It comes down from above, it means.
Love is the secret of beneficial association between personalities. You cannot really know a person as the result of a single contact. You cannot appreciatingly know music through mathematical deduction, even though music is a form of mathematical rhythm. The number assigned to a telephone subscriber does not in any manner identify the personality of that subscriber or signify anything concerning his character. Mathematics, material science, is indispensable to the intelligent discussion of the material aspects of the universe, but such knowledge is not necessarily a part of the higher realization of truth or of the personal appreciation of spiritual realities. Not only in the realms of life, but even in the world of physical energy, the sum of two or more things is very often something more than or something different from the predictable additive consequences of such unions. The entire science of mathematics, the whole domain of philosophy, the highest physics or chemistry could not predict or know that the union of two gaseous hydrogen atoms with one gaseous oxygen atom would result in a new and qualitatively superadditive substance, liquid water. The understanding knowledge of this one physiochemical phenomenon should have prevented the development of materialistic philosophy and mechanistic cosmology.
Notice what he's doing, just what I was pointing out with the whole shadow cast thing. If you, it's like, okay, you got a little bit of logical thinking, but take it all the way. Don't go come up short. Think it all the way through, and you'll see that the whole picture, and you won't go off on that false tangent. If we would, have just thought some of these basic things through over the last 2,500 years, we wouldn't be in the mess we are right now, where we've totally devalued philosophy into this materialistic philosophy, which of course means it's just a so-called philosophy, because philosophy is fundamentally a relationship between science and religion. You only have an ism, predicated on matter. You don't have a genuine philosophy if it's a materialistic philosophy. And cosmology, is fundamentally metaphysics. It's that branch of philosophy that is dealing with the origin and nature of the universe. So it's philosophy again, fundamentally. We've really thrown out philosophy, and we now declare that cosmology is a science. It's a mechanistic, so-called cosmology, just like it's a materialistic so-called philosophy, materialism or naturalism or something like that. We've just totally devalued. We've taken these things that are about the intermediate domain, the fundamentally super-additive domain. Mind is the super-additive consequence of the relationship between matter and spirit. If you want to think about it in a more appropriate sense, instead of going up through it in your initial experiential way of from matter through mind to spirit, really matter and spirit are on the same plane, and there's a super additive consequence. There's hydrogen and oxygen, and there's the super additive consequence of water. Okay. Philosophy and cosmology, are related to things that should be above. And right now we're reading a series of five papers that you can call the cosmology papers. Okay, in the genuine or the true sense of the word cosmology, not material or mechanistic. Cosmology, not false cosmology like we have these days. These are the five cosmology papers in the true sense. We finally have revealed to us true cosmology. We aren't laboring to try to somehow exalt physics into metaphysics, into cosmology, and getting it all goofy. Okay, we have it revealed to us down from above. That's what we're reading right now. We're reading cosmology. It's been a while since we've talked about, physics sorts of things. We're not just talking about mechanistic cosmology. We aren't just talking about the arrangement of the galaxies or something. Okay, we're talking about true cosmology, and it includes the whole picture. The universe is not just material. Mind, matter, and spirit are equally real. Oh, by the way, did you notice that it didn't say matter, mind, spirit there? It said mind, matter, spirit. Yeah. Matter, spirit, mind. Just like, we'll do truth, beauty, and goodness instead of beauty, truth, goodness. Yeah. Beauty, truth, goodness in the technical order like this. Yeah. We'll say truth, beauty, goodness, mind, matter, spirit. Same order, because we start with mind, right? That's where our consciousness is. Then the next thing we go figure out is that there's matter on this end, and then we figure out that there's spirit on this end. That's the order in which we discover them. First mind, then matter, then spirit. First truth, then beauty, then goodness. All right.
Technical analysis does not reveal what a person or a thing can do. For example, water is used effectively to extinguish fire. That water will put out fire is a fact of everyday experience, but no analysis of water could ever be made to disclose such a property. Analysis determines that water is composed of hydrogen and oxygen. A further study of these elements discloses that oxygen is a real supporter of combustion and that hydrogen will itself freely burn. Your religion is becoming real because it is emerging from the slavery of fear and the bondage of superstition. Your philosophy struggles for emancipation from dogma and tradition. Oh, that's a verb. Your philosophy struggles for emancipation from dogma and tradition. Your science is engaged in the age-long contest between truth and error while it fights for deliverance from the bondage of abstraction, the slavery of mathematics, and the relative blindness of mechanistic materialism.
Okay. You know I've got to say something about that. Okay. So, yeah, it's the age-long contest between truth and error. And, of course, we're now losing the contest. It was bad enough when all, we had was bondage of abstraction, slavery of mathematics, and the relative blindness of mechanistic materialism. That materialistic philosophy and mechanistic cosmology they mentioned up there. But now, where it's really getting grim, because now our science is... descending, into the slavery of fear and the bondage of superstition. What they said about religion. We were trying to pull religion up out of that, and science was helping a lot with that. That's one of the reasons why your religion is becoming, why they have an ing word there, is because despite the issues in science, even at the beginning of the 20th century, it was enough to be getting some ing happening in religion. Something was moving a little bit. We were starting to deal with the slavery of fear and the bondage of superstition. But now it's lost. Now science is slavery of fear and bondage of superstition. Like I've pointed out, like the bondage of superstition part. What is a superstition? It's literally something that it's that which stands over, super, above, stands above. It's that overarching notion that you think stands above, the universe that you experience. Okay? And it used to be the Almighty was that superstition, the exalted volcano god, you know, is what, you know, overarched everything. And the Lord, you know, the Almighty worked in mysterious ways and, you know, killed people with hurricanes and who knows why and et cetera. All that, you know, that ignorant superstition. You know, well, we're right back to that again. Since we don't call it the Almighty, now we call it dark energy. It's the ignorant superstition. It's the thing that, you know, it is the thing that dominates the entire universe. It stands above everything else. That's the definition. That's what they mean by the dark energy. Most of the of what, you know, they tell you that we currently believe that most of what we observe is ruled by that fact. You know, completely dominantly ruled by that which stands above it all, the dark energy.
But fear not, it's benevolent.
Well, the black holes are benevolent. Yeah, and that's where the slavery of fear comes in. You know, you're fearful for your little self. It's like, don't worry, you know, black holes are benevolent. You know, you don't need to fear. Right, it's just we have pleasing fables and ignorant superstition masquerading as science now. And it started because we corrupted, you know, the tenuous beginnings of philosophy. If your whole approach to the universe is not grounded in logic, you know, if it's not geology, the logic of the earth, if it's just rationalization schemes about rocks, okay, you've got nothing. It needs to be the logic. It needs to be predicated on the logical acumen. You know, it needs to be biology, the logic of life, not rationalization schemes about life, or even worse, just belief in magic about life. That's not biology. Yeah, that's ignorant superstitions and pleasing fables.
Are more so-called scientists now giving up this idea about the original explosion?
Big Bang?
Yeah, the Big Bang theory.
No, I mean, there's no great threat to that as the dominant notion. What they call the Big Bang Theory keeps changing, you know, but it's getting worse, not better. Becoming more and more magical, more and more illogical all the time, because there's no philosophy. You know, they think that matter is self-clarifying, self-revealing. You just look at it and it reveals its truth, you know, through the microscope or the telescope or whatever. No, you have to have consecrated your mind to the universal harmony before you start looking. Otherwise, there's no hope that you're going to have any sort of a logical recognition and a valid interpretation of what you're observing. You're just going to put new wine in old wineskins, you know. And if the more you let go of religion and God, and I mean, all you've got is fear and ignorance. And so that's what we see through microscopes and telescopes now. You know, confirmation that it's a universe pervaded by our fears and our ignorance. It's pitiful. it gets to that nihilistic, magical point, yes.
Mortal man has a spirit nucleus. The mind is a personal energy system existing around a divine spirit nucleus and functioning in a material environment. Such a living relationship of personal mind and spirit constitutes the universe potential of eternal personality. Real trouble, lasting disappointment, serious defeat, or inescapable death can come only after self-concepts presume fully to displace the governing power of the central spirit nucleus, thereby disrupting the cosmic scheme of personality identity. Presented by a perfecter of wisdom acting by authority of the Ancients of Days.
Okay, let me just make one more little point about this last, because this is a really kind of a fun thing that they do right at the end here. You have an immediate thing that you see there. Come only after self-concepts presume fully to displace the governing power. In other words, if you put yourself at the center of the universe instead of the Isle of Paradise in the first source and center, if there's self-righteousness, as opposed to genuine righteousness, conformity with the cosmos. Okay. So that's pretty obvious, you know, what they're getting at there. But it's the sentence is very carefully constructed to get you to go, wait a minute. That very fact that they word it in that way, self-concepts, just as soon as I say that, a couple of you should go, wait a minute, I know where Chris is going. Yeah, it's exactly where they want you to go. You know, up in paper 118, remember when we were going through the Supreme Papers? You can flip there if you want. If on page 1301, up in paper 118, section 7, 1301 in the single column, remember how there was a paragraph, just a short little paragraph, but it was packed full of self-hyphen words, and we, you know, there was a handout I put out, you know, we went through all of that, just, you know, bit of discovery about how they were showing how we are made in the image of deity, all the various facets of deity, all these self-labeled facets of deity, you know, self-actuality facets of deity, you know, like self-willed deity and self-personalized deity and all that. And they had all these other self-words describing us. So it's right in the That paragraph is the third from the last paragraph in section 7. The third full paragraph down on page 1301 in the single column. But right after that is another paragraph, which has a great little tidbit in it. Self-words again. Okay, in that paragraph it says, but if personality has the prerogative of exercising volitional choice of reality identification. Ooh, wait a minute, this is already sounding like that paragraph we just read. And if this is a true and free choice, then must evolving personality also have the possible choice of becoming self-confusing, self-disrupting, and self-destroying. The possibility of cosmic self-destruction cannot be avoided if the evolving personality is to be truly free in the exercise of finite will. Four words. Self-confusing, self-disrupting, self-destroying, and self-destruction. Remember when we talked about that? What is that sequence of four? That's error, evil, sin, and iniquity. Self-confusing, self-disrupting, self-destroying, self-destruction, error, evil, sin, iniquity. It's the same sequence here. How did they word it here? That same sequence of four things is here. The thing that should have, you know, that really, besides the self-concepts, besides that hint, and you noticed as they went on and they said, thereby disrupting. So you have self-concepts and the word disrupting, that should have reminded you of that sequence of four self-words, okay? And you have this real trouble, lasting disappointment, serious defeat, or inescapable death. Well, what is inescapable death? That's iniquity. I mean, what kind of death is inescapable? Only iniquity is inescapable death. Every other death is escapable, okay? You know that inescapable death is iniquity, and you just got, you see the word disrupting, and you see the self-hyphen concept. I mean, that, real trouble, error. Yeah, in a full personal context here, you know, real trouble, okay? That's error, lasting disappointment, that's evil, serious defeat, that's sin. And see, an inescapable death is iniquity. It's the same sequence. And the more you dig into the etymology of those words compared to the four, compared to confusing, disrupting, destroying, you'll really see that they're literally the same words. Okay? The root of the word trouble, you follow the root, you end up right. It's like, well, and one of the things that means is confused. It's the same thing, self-confusing.
Why are you troubled? Why are you confused?
You know, trouble, it's like the root there is like turbid. All muddled, confused. It's the same sequence, self-confusing, self-disrupting. You know, like disappointment. I mean, that means, you know, taken away from a right arrangement, deranged. You know, that's like disrupted. Right?
I wasn't appointed, but now I'm disrupted.
Yeah, remember, you know what, you know, that's evil. You know, if you take the unity out, you know, you become deranged. If you take out your relationship to spirit and the cosmos, you become insane. You become deranged.
They use disruption in relation to mind, too, and they call it this, like a description of mind disruption, which is loss of personality control.
Right. See, so it's just masterfully constructed. It's the same sequence. So that's what they wanted you to put that together, to connect it to paper 118 and go, way, how cool is that? You know, it's so cool that you can, you know, look up the word trouble and see what its root is, and you go look up that, and then right there is the word confused. It's like, huh. they're just so clever at this. I just had to point that out. It's just delightful the way they do this.
Oxygen, water thing's pretty cool too.
Right, and bringing in using that. You know, and you know, and you know, we didn't mention it because it's pretty, you know. But just notice how strong they are, you know, and the way and the strength of what they say there. Of course, you know, it always strikes you that the entire science of mathematics, the whole domain of philosophy, the highest physics or chemistry could not predict or know. I mean, it's a very strong statement. Yeah. All right, so that takes us through some true philosophy. Say, true philosophy doesn't just talk about galaxies. It talks about, you know, error, evil, sin, and iniquity, and the whole ball of wax, all in one unified picture. And you can notice what allows us to have such a unified picture. This, a threefold actuality with unity. It's so fundamental. You know, if you have a cosmology that's predicated on that, you don't just have matter. You have the whole picture. In the same way that you can understand how galaxies work, you understand about how persons work. Mm-hmm. It's all one picture. Yeah. And so now we're going to shift gears again. You see where we go in the next paper. We're going to do the sacred spheres of paradise next. And we're going to start building out. You know, they do the sacred spheres, then they do the Havona, and then we get the seven super universes. So we're going to get a little bit more in the mode of really mapping out the, you know, the physical layout of things and following it outward. And in the journey, of course, you learn a lot about the personalities that reside on all those material abodes. But we're going to start at the center and work out. You know, we kind of were doing that. We started the Isle of Paradise, but we had this kind of overarching paper, see, that they threw in, because, you know, they wanted to really encourage a full cosmology. You know, they wanted to encourage you to reawaken your relationship with philosophy. We have to stop throwing that out. It's what's corroding everything. It's what this revelation is here to do. It's a philosophical upliftment. You know, it's here predicated on the assumption that you have some measure of relationship to genuine science, some measure of relationship to genuine religion, if you've got some relationship to the fourth epical revelation, and it would like to lead you up from that foundation in a super additive consequence, just like water. See, that's why it ended with that. That's the whole point. That's what the revelation is about, bringing philosophy, that super additive consequence, back into play, because it's above. That's what allows you to look down and really make sure that your science and your religion are not going off track. It's the higher vantage point. You have to have that super additive consequence.
You're not going to get water. I mean, just like you're only going to get water with hydrogen and oxygen, you're not going to get God without philosophy and science.
I mean, you need the full picture, science, philosophy, and religion, and to see it in that you know, begin to look at it in a top-down point of view. In a top-down point of view, you get to philosophy first, and then comes science and religion. Truth, okay, and then beauty and goodness. Okay?
Which are the five cosmology papers?
11, 12, 13, 14. 15, you know, the ones we're reading right now here. These, because you remember you have this, you have three sets of five papers. You have the first, you have the three on the Father, and then the three on, I mean, the five on the Father, and then the five on the rest of existential deity, and now the five on cosmology. You have a threefold Pentateuch here. All right, let's take a moment here.